welcome to the latest episode of Your Wealth with Gemma Dell, a podcast series designed to help you create, grow, and protect your wealth.
Hi, and welcome to Your Wealth. I'm Gemma Dell, NAB Trades Director of SMSF and Investor Behaviour. As all our listeners would be aware, after several years of abnormally low volatility and happily positive market returns, 2018 was a bit of a rude awakening for quite a few people. Markets largely ended the year below where they started. Core sectors came under pressure and investors found that there weren't a lot of safe havens last year other than cash, which was offering rates, frankly, below the rate of inflation for many people. But it's worth noting that while volatility was at record lows for a long time, it's not anything new. So anyone who's been around for a while wouldn't be hugely surprised by this. And it could be considered a return to normal rather than this sort of horrible new world we weren't prepared for. Fidelity International has produced some excellent research on the impact of volatility and strategies for managing it. And today I'm fortunate to have Alva Devoy, Fidelity's Managing Director in Australia, here to offer some thoughts. Alva has a career spanning many facets of both the buy and sell sides of equity markets, research and portfolio management, and she's incredibly well qualified to give her insights on this topic. Alva, thanks so much for joining me.
Delighted, Gemma.
So Alva, let's start a bit of where we are now. Does this feel unfamiliar to you after the last few weeks or last few months? Do you think we've sort of entered a brave new world, or is this pretty normal, the circumstances we're experiencing right now?
So I see it as pretty normal. What we have experienced over the last few years, especially after the global financial crisis that took down markets in 2008, investors may remember this, you know, massive worry period around then, but, you know, Australia emerged unscathed. We had a short period of downside performance in Australian shares, and then, you know, normalization resumed their upward trend. We have had low volatility across all regions and across all asset classes for a long period because internationally the central banks were cutting rates, were providing liquidity, easy money into the system. And we did that here in Australia as well. You may remember we peaked out at 7.25%, and now we are where we are in terms of rates, and we haven't moved for a long period of time. But that has been a huge support to markets, all markets. And in late 2017, there was a shift. We moved in the US towards a tightening bias, so rates going back up, and also draining easy money from the system as well, because internationally, economies and markets no longer needed that support. So I actually thought volatility would come back a lot quicker. In the heel of the hunt, it emerged late last year, and that was driven in part, if I take a step back, we had rising rates for a period of time. That didn't cause a huge amount of concern in markets, but late last year, the concerns increased around recession internationally, predominantly in the US. So we've had a period of rate rising. Oh my God, you're actually going to stamp out the return, the economic growth. We're going to go into recession. And in part, you know, the whole US-China trade wars, etc., then Brexit in Europe added to that as well. So right now where we stand, we've had an increased period of volatility. We have had price declines, which means there's a lot more value around in markets. And yet the fundamentals or the economic data that's coming through is still really, really healthy.
So probably a question before we should have gotten started. What is volatility? Like, how should investors think about it? What does it mean to say markets are, we know what it means to say markets are volatile, but when we talk about volatility, what are we thinking of?
Okay, so very good question, because the one thing we do need to distinguish is volatility from risk. So market gyrations, let's take the Australian StockX, ASX 200, you know, moving up and down, oscillating. But if it's oscillating, you know, moving in small amounts upwards and downwards, but generally on a rising trend, that's generally what you'd see. Nothing goes up in a straight line. When you see in markets what we call gapping up or gapping down, so these big moves, shifting up or shifting down, that can be a cause for concern, because it's markets that move in those fashions are usually indicating some level of dislocation. Yeah. And then there's just, you know, let's take out the rising trend metric and then just let's look at volatility, where it is, it's very difficult to distinguish. We're moving up and down. Are we on a rising trend? Mm. Are we on a flat trend? Or are we on a downward trend? And this is where volatility gets hairy, because if you move into a period in markets where you're on a downwards trend, and yet you as an investor decide, oh, you know, this stock I wanted to buy has gone down 5%. Mm. I want to own it. I'm going to purchase, but actually it's repricing lower over time. Then obviously you're going to sustain losses. And that's where you move into volatility being an indicator of risk. So volatility in and of itself, price moves up and down, not risk. Mm. But if, you know, those price moves are on a sustained downward trend, then you have risks of losing your money. And that's where the two kind of join together. So for us in investing, volatility is absolutely normal. And for active asset managers like Fidelity, we look to use volatility to our advantage. Mm. We want to take these zones of volatility where prices may be impacted of excellent companies, you know, and yet there's no change to their underlying businesses, no change to our expectations of their earnings. And we use this opportunity to buy those stocks. Same on the other side. We have periods where markets and stocks overextend and their valuations become extended relative to the underlying fundamentals, in part because investor sentiment gets really, really positive, you know, as in everybody wants to own Apple.
Yeah.
And now look what's happened, you know, a small stumble, you know, compared to the fantastic trajectory we've seen for the last few years. And, you know, the stock reprices. Mm. Do we think the long-term trend for a company like Apple is good? Therefore, do we think it's a good time to buy? And that's where we get involved.
I think that's it's a really helpful explanation for people, and it has been fascinating the last few months. Certainly the first half of 2018 was incredibly boring for someone like myself, where you're like, oh God, it was up again. You know, like literally every day. All right, yep, markets are up, excellent. You know, and it's quite tedious to observe. After a while, we think there's nothing here I want to buy. Everything just seems a little bit too expensive and nothing interesting. And then the second half of 2018, things changed quite a bit. And you would see Apple being a great example, with 8% wiped off the price in one night. Yeah. I mean, 8% is material, right? It was quite astonishing, some of the repricing movements that were happening. So it's good for investors to sort of see it in that context, the difference between small gyrations in the market and then those really wild swings we've seen lately, quite interesting.
Yeah.
So you've managed equity portfolios worth millions, maybe billions of dollars, I don't know, and you've had to weather all these different periods of up and down in different markets, and it's not possible for a fund manager to do the job unless they can withstand some kind of volatility, right? You'd lose your mind, I imagine, if it wasn't something you could live with. You've done quite a bit of research about this over the years, and you've drawn on others' research. What are the core principles you use to manage volatility and to manage the fairly normal fears investors have about losing money?
So one of the first things that I would say to your listeners is, especially in the current period, is to you know, remain invested. But the actual structure of your investment portfolio should be more diversified at this juncture. So because there isn't a one-way bet, or it isn't clear that we have a rising trend in markets, and also because we don't have those fantastic supports from, you know, continued low interest rates or easy money, and we're back to normal business cycles, you know, normal business as usual, if inflation comes in, interest rates will rise, etc., etc., you have to have a more diversified portfolio. And when I talk about portfolios, if I was purely just looking at stocks, then I would be looking for each of my stock positions to have different drivers. Mm. So some might be exposed to economic cycles, let's say an iron ore stock would be exposed to how China does. So everything's been beaten up because we're all worried about China. And yet, if you looked at short-term iron ore prices, they've actually held up really, really well. Mm. The stocks have been beaten up, but their balance sheets are strong. So, you know, that's two different kind of stock investments on into will the banks provide a return in Australia looking forward. You know, it appears they're doing it tough. We're seeing all the negative news coming through the Royal Commission and the media. And you have to ask yourself the question, is all of the negative news now in the price? Is this a good time to get involved? So that's inside a stock portfolio, looking at different drivers. And then more broadly, for your SMSF investors, a lot of those who would be invested via SMSFs in Australia are very Australia focused. So the last ATO numbers told us it's about 40% exposure to Australia. That's quite concentrated. Mm. And within that then, you know, if I look at the potential for an investor to own their own property, their house, they will probably have an investment property through their SMSF. If they're invested in Australian shares, they're invested in the bank shares. Mm. And that may look diversified, but it's actually exposure to Australian housing risk.
Yes.
So quite substantial exposure.
Yeah. Exactly. So again, just because your assets are in different asset classes, if their drivers of growth and returns are the same driver, be very, very careful. Mm. So how can you look to diversify? You can obviously buy international stocks. You could buy funds. So if you want to stay invested in Australia, buy, you know, an actively managed diverse portfolio of Australian stocks across the whole market, or purchase international funds all the way through to obviously more uncorrelated assets to equities. That's another diversification tool. So an asset class such as bonds that behaves differently to equities in a downturn. So equities go down, your bonds hold up, and so you protect your downside risk. And this is a good time to be invested in those types of assets.
Your point about sovereign super funds is a really interesting one. I was literally interviewed a moment ago where they were saying, you know, how is the performance of self-managed super funds? It's actually been consistently comparable with large funds, right? Mums and dads managing their own money have consistently done as well as big professional fund managers, which is extraordinary when you think about it, right? It's pretty impressive. But their asset allocation is dramatically different. They tend to have a really high allocation to cash and a really high allocation, as you say, to Australian equities, very small allocation to international equities. But we have seen that grow quite dramatically over the last few years because they realised how much performance they were giving away, and also some of the concentration risks of staying in the Australian market, which is obviously quite concentrated in a number of sectors and didn't mostly give you exposure to the stuff they were keen on, like technology and rise of the Asian consumer and those sorts of things. So you've made a few comments about liquidity and reduced rates and the support they've provided for asset prices over the last decade. And it has been an extraordinary period, right? You know, I don't think when I was studying I ever imagined we would see anything like it. I think most people wouldn't have imagined they would see anything like it for that period of time. You know, you understand the Keynesian drivers behind it, but they're supposed to happen for a couple of years, not for a decade. So it's been fascinating. There are many people predicting 2019 is going to be a pretty tough year for markets. What are your thoughts on that prediction?
So I'm not that concerned given the blow off that we have just had across asset classes. But I do think now is a period to be very, very discerning. So deciding that you just want exposure to a particular market or a particular sector and everything is going up, therefore I'm just going to make money, that period has shifted. You need to be much more discerning in your choice, much more vigilant on the downside risk, but also I think, you know, having allocation to more defensive assets, as we said, around the diversification piece. So that being said, the route that we've just seen in markets is throwing up opportunities. We are seeing more attractive valuations across, be it Australian stocks individually, but also in specific markets, which are going to display absolutely phenomenal growth, such as emerging markets in Asia. Mm. So you just know it. You mentioned the demographic shift, the regions where we're going to have much more, you know, demographic support in terms of, you know, youthfulness on one side, but also the rising middle classes, those, you know, who have spending power. It's going to be in emerging markets. And so relative to your developed markets, growth is going to, you know, prevail. And so if you were to sit with a five-year view and look back, this probably will look like an excellent opportunity to get involved in those markets. I look at two of the big macro issues for emerging markets, one being the strengthening US dollar on one side, but also oil prices on the other. And our view is we've now reached the pinnacle of US dollar strength. We know we're going to slow in terms of rate rises from here. So even if we do have more rate rises, I think a lot is already priced into the US dollar. And oil prices have cratered on the other side. And if global growth is not going to fall off a cliff, and China in particular, who is a huge purchaser of oil, then one can see that price in particular stabilise and move back up, which is good for emerging markets.
So if an investor is very confident that 2019 is holding a lot of risk, and they're probably, you know, there are some concerns about emerging markets with mostly US denominated debt as much as anything else, and obviously some emerging markets more than others, and risks across the global economy. But if, let's say I'm an investor who's very, very worried about those sorts of things. I'm worried about the end of QE. I'm worried about rising interest rates. I'm worried about tariffs and trade wars, which is the one we hear about a lot from our investors. And the other one is the falling property market in Australia. So they seem to be the things that concern our investors the most. How would you suggest that investors act on those fears? How do they position themselves?
Yeah. So you need to choose an active manager. That's number one. So if you want to buy units in a fund that is exposed to emerging markets as your entry point, choose an active manager. How do you discern then a manager that is A, truly active? And what do I mean by that? And I'll come on to that. And B, how do I measure that they're going to protect my money on the downside as well? So let's talk about passive and active. So eternal debate. We, as a house, Fidelity and my personal view is passive plus active is a great ecosystem for investors. We need the two. It is a healthy ecosystem for both to be available to investors. And passive has made investing, you know, easy and accessible to a much wider investor base. And that can only be a good thing for the future, for all of us to be saving, for, you know, and ensuring our financial well-being in the future. That is a good thing. And there are points where passive is absolutely the way to go. So what do I mean by passive? I mean making a decision that as an investor, I purely want exposure to a particular market or a particular asset class. Let's say the ASX 200. And I think Australian shares are going to rise next year or 2019 this year. And therefore, I just want exposure. It's going to go up. There's low fees for that because it's rules-based investing. The exchange-traded fund that I buy is a mirror of the construction of the ASX 200. If, however, I think some shares in Australia are going to go up, but others may flounder and underperform, then choosing active is the right decision. And by that, I mean buying units in a fund that is not a rules-based fund, that is managed by an individual or team of investment experts who are supported by research professionals. And in doing so, you're investing in a company's expertise around choosing which are the best stocks, which ones to avoid, which is very, very important on the other side, and then constructing a total portfolio to give a fairly smooth ride over the year ahead. How do you, I suppose, separate the wheat from the chaff in this? Because there are some active funds that actually are very close to passive. They're not truly active. And so there are metrics that we use, one of which is active money. So relative to the benchmark or the index that these funds are measured against, how much of their decisions is actually active? In the Australian market, most active managers would be at about 40% to 45% active money. If I was looking at a global equity fund, that'd be much higher, 85 plus. And then the second metric I would encourage investors to look at, especially today, is downside risk. So when a market such as, let's say, global emerging markets declines 10%, how much does a particular fund decline? And if it's an actively managed fund, it should be going down less than the market. What we call downside capture is a very good measure of that downside risk protection. So if you've got a PM portfolio manager managing fund over time, what is their downside capture relative to the market? If it's consistently a lot less, that's today, especially in a risky asset like emerging markets for all the reasons you just talked about, then that's a good choice.
Yeah, that's value you should be willing to pay for.
Exactly.
So in this market then, risks always exist in every market. 2009 is always a classic to talk about because it was the year that people withdrew the most capital from markets. Just about the time that markets bottomed out, and it would have been very nice to stay invested because the returns subsequent to that point were very nice indeed. There'll be plenty of people who are thinking about withdrawing now going, do you know what? It's been a rough few months. I'm not confident things are going to come back. Your advice would be to stay invested.
It is, yeah, to stay invested. But that's, you know, again, with all that we've just talked about, you know, tuning your investments to the environment is important.
So not blindly invested.
Not blindly invested. So there are a couple of things to mention around that. Exactly to your point of coming out of the market at the wrong time. From behavioural finance, it's usually three punches that you need to take before, you know, as an individual, your psyche goes, I can't take any more. So it's that third quarter of getting a negative return on your super fund or your stockbroker account or your SMSF account coming through. The first hit is like, oh, I can weather this. Second, oh, I'm getting a little bit queasy in my stomach. Third is, I cannot stomach it. And then I'm gone. So just be aware of that, that would be the natural response. The second thing to be aware of is trying as an individual investor to time the market is fraught. So to give you a statistics, if we were to look at the Australian StockX over the last 15 years, the cost of missing the best 10 days of performance would have cost you $12,688. So you put it in dollar terms.
On a portfolio of how much?
That's a $10,000 portfolio.
So from $10,000 invested, you would lose $12,000.
Over that 15-year period.
Over 15 years for just 10 days.
I'm correct in that. It's $10,000. So, you know, staying invested and weathering the storm.
You've got to capture those 10 days.
Yeah. So also, time to time the market increases your transaction costs. And that will just erode your returns over time. The other things to consider as well are, you know, exactly as we said, if you are choosing an active manager to manage your fund, then you would hope the downside risk, that protection on the downside, means that when markets rebound, you're in a very good position to recoup your losses and more. On the other side, one of the things that a point I would make that we need to get way more clear with investors on in Australia is that volatility for those in retirement is very, very negative, right? So for those in accumulation who are contributing to their pension month after month after month from their salaries, dollar cost averaging in accumulation means that you usually benefit from volatility. And what that means is, you know, if I'm going to be adding to my funds over time, I have a long period to make back any losses. And if I'm continuing to buy stocks as they fall, then the average price of my total holding goes down. If you are in retirement and you're not saving, volatility is your biggest enemy. because you lose your dollar. You're not adding to the fund. You're not averaging down your price.
No.
You're just taking the hit. And also you don't have the time to make that money back up on the other side. So volatility management for those already in retirement, and especially those not contributing to their pension today, but taking an income from their pension, is paramount, and we need to get better at it.
Yeah, so the withdrawal component of it is critical. And so my former supervisor at uni has done some incredible work on sequencing risk, which was a term that wasn't even used when I first started doing this. But this issue that if you take a big hit early in retirement phase, that is very different to taking a big hit early in accumulation phase, exactly for the reasons you've described. If you take a big hit within 12 months of retirement and then you're drawing down on that lower balance, then it's going to hurt you really badly. So it's quite challenging for people to think about these things. So there's a great piece of research from Vanguard. Interesting to think about how this ties into sequencing risk. I'm not quite sure. We'll work it out. That says women perform really well as investors relative to men and relative to the average. If you strip out the gender component, the reason for the outperformance was that they changed their portfolio allocations less frequently. And so this was research across a huge number of pension funds. They just split it by gender, but it could have been by behavior type more than anything else. It's the behavior that was what mattered. And those people who were making active decisions to move in and out of the market and change their asset allocation significantly underperformed those who made fewer decisions to move in and around. Does that gel with the kind of research that you guys have done?
Absolutely. Churning your portfolio, increases your transaction costs, massively erodes your returns over time, and then invariably your market timing. Is not fantastic, because what you'll do is take your money out probably as markets are bottoming. Then what are you going to do? You probably wait until you're sure that the uplift has re-established itself before you put your money back in. Whereas if you had stayed invested, then that just wouldn't be an issue. I think there is a necessity for us to look at the decision-making process and where we put our time and resources around our investment decisions. And I think using your time to evaluate exposures that you want to take, or the financial advisor that you want to use, or the asset manager that you want to use, and using your time there is way more appropriate than using your time on, should I be in, should I be out, should I be in cash, etc. It's, where is your core competency? And what's the best use of your mind share when it comes to making investments? And I think, choosing the experts to work with, it's a paramount decision.
The point you're making is excellent too. If we do come back to this question about sequencing risk, rather than being concerned about taking a big hit early on, it's more ensuring that your asset allocation is adequate, that if there is any kind of significant market event on the horizon early in your retirement, that you've got an asset allocation that allows you to withstand that, because you've got enough in cash and defensive assets to support your portfolio, rather than you're heavily invested in equities, take an enormous hit and then have to live with the consequences. And the worst consequence is that you then decide to switch to defensive assets and markets come back.
Exactly.
Which does happen.
So one of the, I've heard a terrific advisor in the market, it's a very simple approach. If he is saying to a client, I have you 50% in defensive assets, such as bonds or term deposits, and I have 50% you're allocated to growth assets. Markets go down 20%. You're only feeling the 10% decline because your defensive assets have done what they're supposed to do. Let's say they do nothing, they just stay stable. Mm. How is that going to feel? Mm. Put the dollar value on it. You have 100,000 invested. You've taken a 10K hit. Mm. How is that going to feel in terms of the income that is now generated off the remaining 90,000? Are you going to be able to take your holiday this year? Are you going to be able to pay your medical bills? And just break it down into that very simplistic, small equation, and then make a judgment call on that in terms of how you should be positioned and who you should get to help you in terms of your positioning.
I think that helps a great deal, and being able to quantify the impact of the volatility in advance really helps, so you know what you may be in for.
Yeah.
People do like to describe the potential downside.
Yeah. put a figure on it, put your figure on it, and then sit back and think what that's going to mean, especially if you're in retirement, to your quality of life in any given year.
All of that brought together, people then need to have all of those considerations in advance. I'm going to suggest after the last 5 years, plenty of people have been just enjoying the ride.
Absolutely.
It's been quite nice, actually. It's been very easy compared to many other periods we've lived through, and perhaps have not given enough attention to some of those issues, right? Your asset allocation gets pretty cruisy when it's all up. And so this time now to rethink your asset allocation, to rethink your strategy, to understand how much downside you're willing to withstand and so on is really helpful. If you're going through that process now, and let's hope people are, a bit of a New Year's resolution type situation, any major global trends that you'd suggest people keep an eye out for, things they should be factoring into their decision-making process?
I guess if we were to look at thematic trends to be aware of in markets that offer the potential for good growth.
People love those ones, they're great.
Yeah. So anything that is backed by demographic trends, to me, is a winner, because the really interesting thing in markets, especially if you've been a forecaster of returns in markets, is demographic trends are the most highly predictable trends out there. Because they're slow emerging trends that, you know, come about over time. Because today, if I was to look at the Australian population and the splits of the population, you know, with a high degree of certainty, I will know how many women are going to be aged 50 at, you know, 2050 here. And also because of, you know, behavioural studies and anthropology becoming really, really important in both society and markets, how we behave, how we consume, we have a much greater degree of certainty, again, how a 50-year-old woman is going to behave and what's going to be important to her at that point in time. So those two things combined help us to identify investments. And as you said, you know, the demographic trend is highly supportive of emerging markets, be it India, China, Asia, etc. The fact that those populations are going to have increased GDP per capita, you know, once you move above the $10,000 per person, you get into the zone of having some free disposable income, and also free time. So what you spend your disposable income on shifts. So it was, you know, the big theme would have been designer handbags purchases across Asia for a period of time. It's now moved well beyond that. But the one thing I would say, that's a great spinal cord to kind of back your investment thesis into. And then what you're looking for is, I would say, a secondary layer there where we know technology stocks have done really, really well, right? Fantastic juice. They have added a huge amount to client portfolios. Now is the period where we should be looking for the companies that are going to use technology to their advantage. It's taking it into the next round, the second derivative. And whether that's a company that's consumer product related, that's going to use data to its advantage. So I'll give you a very basic story around, let's say, Facebook, Instagram, and Estee Lauder. So Facebook buys Instagram, and everybody says, how are they ever going to make money out of that, right? Instagram, we know, is a lot of beautiful people putting up fabulous photographs of themselves. So,
making their lives, you know, very pretty.
Exactly. Yeah. So consumer products companies like Estee Lauder, L'Oreal, etc., would spend on average 14% of their revenue on advertising and promotion. And when you spend on AMP and you're advertising on billboards, in duty-free, and magazines, you don't know which dollar of your AMP spend is generating revenue.
Yes.
Right? Kendall Jenner puts up a photograph on Instagram of, I think it was Ruby Woo lipstick. Don't quote me because it's a little while ago. Yeah. You know, fabulous lipstick produced by MAC, which happens to be one of Estee Lauder's brands. Estee Lauder, very clever. They have individual brands aimed at different demographics. You know, so you're Elizabeth Arden, the older woman, Bobby Brown in the middle, MAC, and for all the men listening, you won't know what I'm talking about, but just, you know, come with me on this journey. Yeah.
It's very profitable. Get on board.
Yeah. So MAC is the younger brand. She posts her photograph. You know, in a very short space of time, she gets 2 million likes. Estee Lauder has already put in place enterprise-wide software, SAP-backed, which is its stock management tool. They get the X million likes on Instagram. They stock out in certain areas. So they know, right, she's resonating with this, you know, region, let's say the US plus maybe Europe, etc. But they also, and so they can, they know their dollar of AMP has hit home. They know where they're selling out their lipsticks, where they need to restock fast to maintain those sales. So you can just see it's the power has shifted to that type of company that's using both the social media side, but also its technology internally to maximize sales and maximize the efficiency of those sales. So I've taken you on a bit of a ramble there, but those are the sort of companies that we're looking for today. Those that are building in technology into their DNA and leveraging it. One other area, which is completely unsexy, but you know, is around food and water. So if we're going to have the, you know, world's population continue to grow, and I think, you know, the metric was 50 billion by 2034 from the World Health Organization. We know that arable land, the land available, you know, to actually grow crops, etc., is restricted, possibly declining because we're building houses, etc., on it. And therefore, we need to maximise our yields. So, you know, a company, let's say, like Monsanto, which to many might be an anathema because of genetically modified seeds and Roundup, etc., etc., it has moved into, and I'm using it as an example, it has moved into a realm called precision agriculture, okay? They bought a company that has these GPS-controlled planters. Their data systems, they have mapped millions of acres of arable land. They have mapped that in terms of, you know, conditions, soil type, etc. Then they have a whole data system around weather and weather forecasts. And so based on what's happening with the weather, matching it to the soil that they're planting at any one time, they can program via GPS, no human intervention, what depth and spacing that machine should plant the seeds at to get maximum return. So that's where technology is helping a company like Monsanto generate sales, but where, you know, the need for food, we know that's demographically driven.
So yes, it's shifts, a very real problem.
Yeah. So it's shifts like that that we're looking to, if you were asking me around, you know, about themes and trends.
Any final thoughts for investors as they do face into 2019?
Final thoughts. be brave, okay, but be judicious at the same time. So it is not, you know, I'm just going to put my money to work, lock it in the bottom drawer and leave it. Today is definitely an interesting period to be taking on more risk, but make sure that your portfolios are well diversified so that you can withstand the volatility. And then, you know, focus some time on working out how you are going to adjudicate between, you know, those experts that you need to help you, be it your financial advisor or be it the asset manager who's going to be a steward of your money. And I've given you some of the metrics that I would advise you to use.
Alva, you guys produce a fantastic amount of content and really great simple strategies for people to employ when they're thinking about investing their money. Where do they go to find those?
Sure. So we have our Fidelity website, Fidelity International www.gemadale.com.au, I think is the right one. I might have to come back to you on that. We've changed it. So we do have our website.
Google Fidelity International. Yeah. And you'll find it.
That will bring it up. So we have a huge amount of education material pretty much that sits there all the time. We also have, you know, a tool which will, you know, help you check out, you know, how much money you would have lost or made if you'd stayed invested in different markets as well through periods of volatility.
Well, that's really helpful. I think a lot of people enjoy playing around with that.
So you can actually test our thesis. But also we are publishing new data continuously up onto that website. And also something that your listeners may be interested in, we have launched our first active ETF, which we didn't get into today. But for those who have a stockbroker account who also want to buy units in funds.
So a lot of NabTrade investors really love ETFs, love the new type of actively managed ETFs, really interested in those listed solutions when they're after a portfolio rather than a single stock.
Exactly. Yeah. And what they're designed to do is take the friction out of purchasing for an investor. So exactly as you would purchase your CBA shares, you can instruct your broker to buy units in actively managed funds. We can now trade on exchange. We're one of a number now in Australia. It's a growing trend. The benefits include the fact that you don't have to go through, you know, KYC, AML, and sign up for a new account with an individual asset manager.
784 pieces of paper,
exactly.
That sort of thing.
And you can see in your one portfolio statement your shares next to the units in funds that you have purchased. And so you can monitor how each are doing together. And then, as I said, it's a phone call or an online trade to trade. If you're interested in learning more about that, we have a whole suite of modules on the website to educate. So that's educating on what are ETFs, educating on active ETFs, what the Fidelity one does, et cetera, et cetera. So up to you to self-serve, depending on what your level of interest is.
Awesome. I think lots of people would love. Alva from Fidelity International, thank you so much for joining me today. As always, thank you so much for listening to this episode of the podcast. We hope it has been helpful in your journey to creating wealth. We always love to hear from you, so if you have any feedback or suggestions for future topics, please just email us at yourwealth@nab.com.au. I'm Gemma Dale. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for listening to Your Wealth with Gemma Dale. To stay up to date, please subscribe to this podcast series or email us at yourwealth@nab.com.au.
Please note that any advice provided in this podcast has been prepared without taking into account your objectives, financial circumstances, or needs. Before acting, you should consider the appropriateness of the information. To find out more, please visit nab.com.au.